Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. With Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into the one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. Get hardware that fits your business, take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/theathletic, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/theathletic to take your retail business to the next level today. shopify.com/theathletic.
The Athletic.
I'm sorry, you can sit there and look and play with all your silly machines as much as you like.
Is Gascoigne going to have a crack? He is, you know. Oh, I say! Brilliant!
He's round the goalkeeper, he's done it! Absolutely incredible!
He launched himself 6 feet into the crowd and kung fu kicked a supporter who was without a shadow of a doubt giving him lip.
Does it tame and tame and tame again?
Crank up the music! Charge your glass! This nation is going to dance all night!
An open-top bus parade, OBEs all round, even for Aaron Ramsdale, National Three Lions Day, a limited edition commemorative coin paid for in 12 equal monthly instalments, a child named Jordan, Kyle, Harry, John, Luke, Calvin, Declan, Bakayo, Mason, Raheem, Harry, and some very angry football gods. Brought to your ears by The Athletic, this is Football Clichés. Right now you can subscribe to The Athletic for a special price of £1 a month for 6 months. You'll enjoy great analysis and in-depth features from the very best football writers around, as well as ad-free versions of all of our podcasts. So go to theathletic.com/clichéspod to take advantage of this special discount. That's theathletic.com/clichéspod. Hello everyone and welcome to episode 80 of the Football Clichés podcast. I'm Adam Hurry and with me, first of all, David Walker. You know what's coming. You know what's coming here. You've dug yourself into this hole. Chris Truckle writes in and he says, what is the acceptable amount of time to leave your wall chart on the wall after the final? Once you've filled in the winner box, it seems silly to take it down that night, agreed, but a week seems too long, also agreed. Can you and your team help decide this? He's made us sound like Ground Force.
It's a great question, one I hadn't really considered. You know, I suppose it's a bit like a Christmas tree, isn't it? Or a, you know, birthday card or something. Yeah. But and also, it's just reminded me that I think I had my 2014 wall chart up for about 2 years. In my old place, we just never took it down. Once it was up, once it sort of passed a certain point, it's like becomes like a part of the scene, part of the furniture. It's just like another thing on the wall. But it was too long that, yes. I think a week. Yeah, I think maybe a week. Maximum.
What are you going to be doing? What pleasure are you going to be getting from your wall chart just 4 or 5 days later?
Sitting there looking, reminiscing about great games and I just think this the is month it. We've had.
Fair enough. Alongside you is James Moore. We pretty much only have one thing to share with you straight away. This is Clive Tilsley doing Czech Republic, Denmark the other night. Cue clip.
I bet Vladimir Sokol fancied his chances chasing back there against the right-footed Mailer. Go on, show us your swinger. Let's see what you can do. Ah. See that one coming.
No, neither did I.
I mean, if you're going to say something like that, I suppose McCoist is the guy to have alongside you in the implied commentary gantry.
It's not impossible McCoist has said that before, is it?
I mean, juvenile as this is, James, I mean, at the time I suddenly questioned myself, is that a synonym for what I'm thinking it's a synonym for? I don't want to make a silly joke here on the podcast if it's not.
I don't think it's a traditional one, but I think it certainly sounds like it could be.
Yeah, yeah.
If you're lucky enough to have one that's sufficiently swingable.
Yeah, that is true.
Certainly, yes. The adjudication panel opens its proceedings with this, Dave. I thought about this so much over the last 24 hours or so, I've muddled my brain completely. George Warby says, are you able to discuss what role, if any, the footballing gods are having at Euro 2020? What are the football gods? Is it like Lady Luck? I know the phrase is, and I feel like if I heard it in normal conversation, I'd suddenly have an image of it. But now I've thought about it so much, I just don't know anymore.
I think, the footballing gods certainly shining down on England at the moment.
Right.
But they're like the sort of, you know, they're the people that write the script, I think.
Okay. Roger Ellis wades into the debate, James, and he says, if there are footballing gods, plural, as in most polytheistic setups, they probably have different roles. Rather than gods of war, love, wine, etc., what are footballing gods' roles? The god of strikers? The god of extra time? The god of late substitutions? Definitely overthinking it there, isn't he?
No, surely it'd be kind of deflections and like scuffed penalty spots and things like that. Those are the things that kind of feel like more like divine intervention, right?
The difference I had in mind between that and Lady Luck, Dave, is I thought maybe football gods were kind of more kind of all-encompassing things, like your fortunes across a season or a tournament. So the football gods are smiling on you because you've done well in this tournament, rather than a shot going in off the post.
But like a sort of spirit guide looking over you throughout your season.
More of a long-term, you know, deity.
I just sort of envisaged them in my head as actually like, it'd be nice if they were like four old blokes in blazers like the FA in a wood-panelled room. Just sort of deciding who to be nice to and who not to be nice to.
The FA Council definitely think they are the football gods, don't they? Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. Well, George, I hope we got somewhere to getting to the bottom of that. On to even more exciting matters, James. Samuel Simmons asks, long-sleeved shirts, a genuine dying breed? Can only think of a few players who wear them. Varane, Ronaldo, maybe a couple more. Can you even buy a long-sleeved shirt of your favourite team now? I hadn't thought about this, and now I think about it, I can't picture many players in genuine long sleeves.
Well, I thought I could picture one, but actually it turned out I was wrong. But within that, I think I've actually solved the mystery. So in my, I very quickly, when I saw this email, I thought to myself, who can I imagine in a long sleeve shirt? And I guess it was because he played for England on Saturday, but the player that came to my mind was Mason Mount. Now, if you imagine Mason Mount now, he's wearing a long sleeve shirt, isn't he? Always wearing a long sleeve shirt. But if you do a Google image search of Mason Mount, which I have done, in every single picture, he's wearing a short sleeve shirt with like a sort of Under Armour thing underneath. My theory is that players are eschewing long sleeve shirts in favour of wearing these base layers instead of in the same colour. So you may occasionally see a player who you think is wearing a long sleeve shirt and in fact they're not.
I mean, but Dave, if even goalkeepers aren't wearing long sleeve shirts anymore, what hope do we have for the outfield?
It is weird. And I thought, when I was thinking about this, I thought, well, maybe it's because, you know, the long sleeve shirt used to be, it was more suited to the shirts that were a bit more baggier back in the old days, and primarily, obviously, a thing sort of used for warmth, I suppose, in the winter months. So I was thinking, oh, obviously, it would look weird if the long sleeve shirts were like really tight. But then, as James said, they do wear all these, you know, the players routinely wear a sort of very tight, the base layer sort of thing. So it's a bit weird. Why don't they have long sleeve shirts? Well, do they? I mean, they must. I bet clubs do give players the option. I bet they are still there, but it's just probably not.
Yeah, I mean,
players don't want them.
You charge a premium for that, I would have thought. But I mean, just bring this closer to home, Dave. I mean, all Sunday league kits are long sleeve by default, it seems.
Not mine.
So what do you do? Oh, yours aren't.
No, and I actually do the, I have a red, our kit's red and white. It's like a sort of Croatia-esque thing. And I often wear a red base layer underneath it.
Oh, interesting.
The only one on the team who does that, actually.
I'm sure I've never worn a base layer. I'm a sleeves rolled up, and then when they start falling down, fold them up kind of guy. It's very, very labour intensive. I have to say, I'm not surprised at the death of the long sleeve shirt. So Samuel Simmons, good shout. Next up, James Stuart Smith, who's been letting this one indeed stew for about a week now. He says, ITV's Joe Spate described Mario Pasalic's 91 minutes, 50 second equaliser as deep into stoppage time when there were 6 added minutes. At what point do we get deep into injury time? As I would argue, we were at the shallower end of the additional time when the ball went in.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I mean, presumably you have to be over 50% of the way through, right? Although, I guess if you've got like you know, 15 minutes added for some terrible injury. Mm. I mean, if it's 7 minutes into 15 minutes, it's going to feel pretty deep, isn't it?
A 50% threshold seems fair, seems logical, and that seems like the first thing to do. But Dave, maybe we should be just using a sort of strict kind of time barrier here. I mean, once you're 90 seconds into injury time, that is deep. You are deep, no matter how much injury time is left.
No, I don't agree. I think deep's got to be in the final minute and a half, a push. I think, you know, you've got to be towards the end. Like, if you're thinking of the swimming pool analogy, you're in the deep end would be right at the end, wouldn't it? Wouldn't be halfway through.
I believe this is what the E17 song is about. So maybe we'll find the hidden meaning there. Deep, deep down. But no, I think maybe James's 50% threshold does make sense. Because, I mean, even allowing for a sort of horrific head injury and 15 minutes of injury time, it would still stand up. So it wasn't... So Mario Pasalic's 90-second minute equaliser was not deep into injury time, Joe Spate. An observation from stateside, Dave, next. Patrick Doherty says, no nation is better any one task than Italy is at encircling soccer referees.
Absolutely.
There are some instant images that come into your mind when you picture an Italian player appealing to the referee. First one, presumably quite obvious. What's the first kind of gesture? The pinching of the fingers. Mm-hmm. Would you be a double pincher or a single pincher? Both hands or one hand?
Oh, I think both.
Because it's more pleading, isn't it?
Both, yeah.
Yeah, the referees say you need both, don't you? It has to be, like you say, it's more pleading, isn't it? It feels more emphatic.
Yeah. I think we really have missed their presence. I think seeing them in this tournament, especially like that last 10 minutes of that game against Belgium, where they were just masterfully... sucking every spare second out of the game, you realise that we do need the Italians. They very much, you know, perhaps in many ways, actually, obviously this team is very unstereotypically Italian, but they still do retain some pleasingly stereotypical Italian qualities, and they were in full show in the quarterfinal.
They've got the balance just right. They're a really adventurous attacking team, yet with all the characteristics that we always believe that they had. Mm. The whole thing is absolutely fantastic. But James, there are secondary things here in the kind of mise-en-scene of Italian referee haranguing. We know that the finger pinching is the first thing, but there was other ones. Bonucci, I think this is when they were walking off at half time and he was still remonstrating with the referee about something. Terrible for a podcast, but I'm going to do it anyway. He did this sort of thing where he kind of just sort of leaned like that. He sort of went.
Yeah, I don't even know how to describe that.
It's kind of a shoulder shrug and a lean.
Look like you're having a stroke.
This is definitely, don't make a clip out of this, for fuck's sake.
I know what you mean. What emotion is that expressing?
And I haven't been able to demonstrate it physically, so it's not going up. It's not going well.
What emotion do you think he's expressing there? So he's sort of like shrugging but leaning.
Yeah, it's a bit like
kind of shoulders
on,
up.
Oh, come on, that's basically what the
is he talking to the ref here?
Yeah.
So this is about the penalty just before half time, presumably.
I assume so. Yeah, it must have been. So it's kind of like, come on, ref. Yeah, come on, ref. Maybe not as significant as I thought. Another classic when they were all really piling around him, and you got someone like Verratti, like a small child as well, trying to irritate the referee. But Bonucci sort of stepping in and sort of wading them back with both arms behind him. I love it when someone takes charge of the remonstrating, James, is what I'm talking about here.
Yeah, it's kind of the opposite of that thing you sometimes see, like, you know, in Larry pubs where someone's sort of saying, hold me back, and actually, like, really sort of ostentatiously pretending they're going to go for someone, but actually kind of not really doing it at all.
It's the polar opposite of that. Yeah. Exactly right. So maybe they would be handy in a pub brawl. Mm. Dave, Henrik Heimli Steiners writes in, and in fact, loads of people tweeted me about this, such as the intensity of the pedantry of this podcast. When Jordan Henderson headed home England's fourth against Ukraine, the official England Twitter account tweeted, "What a time to score your first international goal," provoking a flood of complaint, suggesting that wasn't really what a time to score your first international goal, because it... as Henrik Heimli Steiners points out, can it be used for someone scoring a goal that has no impact in the final outcome of a match?
No, I think that's hard. I think people are being harsh.
It's more of an occasion thing.
Yeah, it's the fourth, because the fourth goal actually is quite, I think it's more important than the third goal in this situation, because it, a 4-0 is like a new, it's a level up from a 3-0 or a 2-0, as we spoke about the other day. It's a proper, and we can get into what the proper word should be. Is it a thrashing? Is it a thumping? I don't know is it a rout? I don't know what you would consider to be the proper word, but it certainly caps off, takes it to a new level. And it's, you know, it's a quarter final, it's an occasion, it properly seals this triumph. And it's his first international goal, and he's sort of it's kind of been a thing. He missed the penalty before the tournament. People sort of know that he hasn't scored now for England because commentators are mentioning it all the time. He's the second most senior player in the squad. So I think the FA's Twitter account is perfectly within their limits to do that.
No, fair enough. They got a little bit carried away, maybe. But I mean, James, I mean, traditionally, what a time to is usually pinned to a pivotal moment in a game, right? Is that fair to say?
Yeah, but then at the same time, you know when Claude Makélélé scored his first goal for Chelsea?
Yes.
It was like a rebound from a penalty in the game where Chelsea won the league title, right?
Yeah, it was against Charlton in 2005.
And that was, I mean, I don't think it was like 4-0, but was it like kind of 4-1 or something like that it made it, I think. I don't think it was like a decisive goal in the game and they'd already won the league. And yet I can imagine it being said because of the kind of, the theatre of it all and the emotion of the day, I can kind of imagine that might be the kind of situation where that might happen. So maybe there is sort of precedent for that.
So the self-contained spectacle of it. Okay, fair enough. Speaking of that England game, Dave, I thought I was watching it quite intently. But there was a moment that completely passed me by. I think I only saw the ball flashing past the post. And that was Kane's sort of left foot volley that nearly sort of flew into the top corner. I don't feel like much has been made of that because that probably would have been the best goal ever scored by England at a major tournament, I think it's fair to say.
Yeah, I can't... I'm trying to... You know, obviously, Gazza, apart from Gazza, there isn't...
Definitely better than Gazza's.
A notable, amazing goal from... I mean, Bobby Charlton in 66 smashed one in from 30 yards, didn't he? But... Yeah, you're struggling, aren't you? This, you know, England goals at tournaments. The images in my mind are headers from corners or scrappy.
Yeah,
you know, Owen, Argentina. Yeah, to be fair, obviously that's an amazing one. That is very much a solo effort.
Yeah,
but yeah, it would have been an absolutely amazing goal. It was so hit with such ferocity.
Yeah,
and it's one of those where you're really annoyed that the keeper saved it. It was like, he tipped it around the, you know, around the post. It was a great save. And it reminded me, maybe this is a bit niche, but maybe people might remember, two seasons ago when Kevin De Bruyne against Arsenal at the Emirates, when he'd scored two amazing goals and then he would have got a hat trick with another amazing goal, but Leno just tipped it onto the post. And I was angry. I was angry that Leno had saved it because it would have been an amazing goal. And I was sort of similar with Kane last night. The roof would have gone off the place, wherever you were watching it would have been amazing.
Would the roof have gone off the Stadio Olimpico? Hang on. Don't try and slide. I know you're tired. You cannot. Hang on. In fact, I'm so irritated that you've not irritated. I'm so intent on debunking that. I'm going to go and find the official attendance of that game and decide, as a proportion of the stadium's capacity, whether the roof was lift offable. I'm doing it now. So 11,880 in a 70,000 seater stadium. Well, would have taken a lot of effort to get the roof off.
I can tell you the roof would have firmly flew off the green pub in Shepherd's Bush where I was watching the game. That had gone in.
Oh, fair enough.
The other thing is it would have been a perfect hat trick as well if you'd scored.
Oh my God. It would have been. Jesus. Wouldn't it be great that the best crowning goal of a perfect hat-trick being the weaker foot one as well? I mean, that's a deluxe perfect hat-trick, surely.
But unfortunately for us, the footballing gods decided that there wasn't the moment for that to happen.
James, I'm sure this is a thing. I mean, not just in this tournament, but maybe sort of England at major tournaments generally. We don't score great goals. There's no cultural or footballing reason for this. I think it is purely a footballing god situation. But I feel like we're very much overdue or deserving of a kind of era-defining England goal at a major tournament. Owen and Gascoigne feel so long ago.
Yeah, that feels a lifetime ago.
Yeah.
The other one I can think of is that joke, and this is a long time ago as well now, really. Yeah. Joko won against Sweden. The kind of dipping volley. You don't look convinced by that.
Just not genuinely a fan of dipping, looping volleys. I mean, they are the wonder goal that anybody could score.
He's kind of spooned it a bit, I guess, hasn't he? It's not,
just putting your boots straight through. I mean, clearly an incredible goal to look at, but just, doesn't tick any of the other boxes.
You're totally right. Mm. I actually, to prove your point, I played Sunday League last week, and in the warm-up, I strode onto the pitch, the ball came to me, and I hit just smashed it as hard as I could from about 30 yards.
Such a warm-up.
And it went in like that. Yeah. Like, it was almost in the same position. Like, you could, it's just, it is very much something that you could do with your swinger.
Mm. I should have mentioned this to Joe Cole when I saw him the other day, but didn't want to tarnish the latter part of his career.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
On to the big theme of this week's episode, James. Now, we've already established on this podcast that I have no patience for people who are anti-fate tempting. We are going to do some fate tempting here and ask what are the classic guaranteed things that are going to happen if England win the Euros? And I'm talking about low-key cultural developments. Actually, first of all, are we going to have a bus parade? There will be one, right?
Surely there will be, yeah. I don't know where it would be. I mean, we're kind of at the point now where that's okay as well, right? It kind of feels like there'd have to be. If you can get 70,000 people inside a stadium, surely you can kind of line the streets of, I don't know, wherever it is.
You could very much see Boris Johnson being triumphant at that press conference and just, if England had won the tournament, using it to kind of kick off some sort of national celebration of, freedom and victory and triumph and it's coming home and all of that stuff. But I think there will be a bus. There will definitely be a bus. Whether or not, how the issue will be where the crowd, obviously the crowd's gathering and lining the streets, and where is it going to go from? Where's it going to end? What's the precedent? Obviously, 1966 was so long ago that nothing that happened then is relevant to what happened now. What was the most recent thing? Rugby World Cup, Ashes 2005? What happened then?
Yeah, they looked on a massive bender.
Yeah, they were all pissed, weren't they, for 3 days? Yeah. Not going to happen with these lads, is it? Sterling isn't going to be pissed for 3 days and rock up to Downing Street with his tie half hanging off his neck and all that.
Who is the most underwhelming member of this squad who will get a statue of England win the Euros? So, obviously there's a statue of the three World Cup winners at West Ham. Will they build a statue of Declan Rice outside the London Stadium?
I don't think they'd require much persuading, West Ham.
And then would they sell the statue to Chelsea when Declan Rice goes to Chelsea?
That's turning the screw. Trying to use the Rugby World Cup winning side of 2003 and the Ashes side of 2005 as kind of benchmarks for this sort of behaviour. Dave, I'm thinking, are we thinking OBEs all round? I mean, that feels like an easy thing to achieve.
Is that what they got?
England rugby squad all got OBEs. Woodward got an OBE and a knighthood at the same time, which feels like, don't need both, do you?
If you get two OBEs, do you get bumped up to MB or what? I mean, how does it work?
I'm
not really expecting to know the answers to that question.
I think MBE is lower.
Oh, is it? Oh, okay.
Yeah, I thought MBE is simply a member.
Oh, of course,
And then you get SB, which is swinger. And then OBE is officer. So for some reason, I mean, I guess it kind of works in a sporting context. The Rugby World Cup winning team were considered better than the Ashes winning side, Dave. I mean, I guess that kind of works in the hierarchy of things.
Yeah, I mean, winning a World Cup, I suppose, is Rugby World Cup would be more difficult than winning an Ashes series. I don't know. I don't want to anger any cricket or rugby fans that may be listening
or the Queen
to this podcast. Yeah, because I think didn't the cricket team do their big thing in Trafalgar Square? I seem to recall them being on top of the bus or coming out on the steps in Trafalgar Square. I think that's what the thing was. But where else would you go? I mean,
Wembley.
It's going to be at Wembley anyway. Yeah. The bloody final will be at Wembley.
Wembley Way is quite well designed for that, actually. They could do it on the concourse, looking down at Wembley Way. It'd be like a sort of presidential inauguration setup. Actually, in fact, Woodward Clive Woodward was 3 years younger than Southgate is now. So Southgate could quite conceivably be a sir.
Yeah, that's got to be done, surely.
Yeah.
Is Gareth Southgate going to be the manager of the British and Irish Lions in 10 years' time?
Yes, definitely. Bringing his quiet... Can you imagine him sort of transferring it to another sport? I think I can, because... actually, there was... On Southgate, there was really... I mean, there was the whole post-match scene of England-Ukraine, James, was quite heartwarming. And they were all declaring their love for Southgate. And there was a bit when Shearer was interviewing him on camera. And it felt... It just dawned on me that Southgate probably feels now like he was kind of like the nerdy one of the England team back in, say, 1996. And I'm not saying he was bullied, but he was probably... I'm just saying he was obviously considered the nerdy kind of one. And now he's England manager. It felt like, I don't know, like a kid kid at school who you didn't think much of, and then turns out, you know, they run an entire pub or something like that, and you're suddenly now kind of at their mercy.
An entire pub?
Yeah, I don't know why I said entire pub. Sorry. Oh, no, a big pub. A big pub.
You're talking about someone specific from your childhood, right?
I've got anyone in mind.
Yeah, you know those films, like it's kind of 80s on early 90s films where there's like a sort of vaguely unattractive child who then becomes like really cool and popular. It's like, it's one of those kind of crap films, isn't it, right?
Yeah, all they had to do was remove their glasses and they were suddenly attractive.
Yeah.
Southgate, I don't know, grew a beard. But yeah, that aside. I just, Dave, I'm not entirely sure I feel hugely comfortable about Aaron Ramsdale getting an MBE. But he was good around the camp, so.
I mean, again, to draw a comparison with the cricket thing, wasn't there a famous thing in cricket where Paul Collingwood got sledged by the Aussies because he got an MBE, but he'd only played it was like an injury replacement or something. I probably got that very wrong, but I think that's a thing. And yeah, I mean, Ben White's probably going to be, I think it's Ben White and Ben Chilwell, they're the only two outfield players that haven't been on the pitch yet. I think that's right. So it'd be someone like that as well, maybe.
But Connor Cody as well.
They're easy targets for this. Yeah, Connor Cody.
Just knight Connor Cody for a laugh. Give Connor Cody a knighthood for a laugh.
No banter knighthood. We're not doing banter knighthoods. No, we're beyond that. We're as serious. This is serious. Give Gary Lewin a honorary.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's kazoo concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's bachelorette bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial. And with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown. And through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
Here are some other inevitabilities. James, Ryan Richardson suggests that social media hype, perhaps even indeed a clamour for a bank holiday in celebration. It will run for a day or so before someone from the government confirms that it won't be granted or it will be too expensive. We could be into demanding bank holiday territory, wouldn't we? That'd be great.
I don't know. Do you get people demanding a bank holiday for sporting success? I mean, I guess we've just not had enough to know. But I don't remember that being a thing after like the Rugby World Cup or Ashes.
Different level.
It's football, though. It's football.
I know. Yes. Oh, don't get me wrong. It is a proper thing.
It's rather
thing
larger
this time.
Than that. Yeah.
I can see the can see some of the papers. I can see the Sun or the Daily Star.
Yeah, that's big. True.
Jumping on even the Daily Mail, maybe jumping on the bandwagon and calling for it.
Demanding.
But it sort of feels like, you know what you mean? Yeah, politicians may take the sensible approach and say, no, we can't do it. But also, you could just picture Oliver Dowden coming out and announcing it, couldn't you? You could.
Definitely. I'll tell you what, I'll do you a deal, James, and Dave indeed. If you got a bank holiday for England winning the Euros, and it was on, you know, same day every year, like the Monday off, whatever. But you had to refer it, by law, you had to refer to it as Three Lions Day. Would you take that deal? You have to refer, you can't call it anything else. You can't call it, I don't know, July bank holiday. You have to call it Three Lions Day.
Yeah, why would I have a problem with that?
I don't know.
Even if you weren't making me call it that, that's what I'd call it.
Yeah.
I'm just going to start calling Sunday that from now on.
Absolutely. No, I'd definitely take it. And I could also envisage, like, you know, such is the ridiculous world we live in nowadays, that there, if this bank holiday, Three Lions Day, becomes a reality, there'll be somebody out there who will take the alternative. Some columnist on somewhere will say, oh, this is a disgrace, it's just football, we didn't get a bank holiday when Prince Philip died, this is an insult to his memory and stuff like that. There'll be a backlash, won't there?
Yeah, that's very conceivable. Taking it to even further extremes, Dave, if it becomes a bit like Christmas, I imagine there'll be people who celebrate Three Lions Day every day of the year.
Absolutely.
Get their England kit, and just for the purposes of featuring in page 7 of a tabloid newspaper. But just, yeah, they celebrate Three Lions every day. They have to have the same meal. What would it be?
George crosses all outside their house every day for the whole year.
Watching a BBC montage as soon as they get up.
To be fair, that is what I've done all weekend. So
yeah, no, true. Also, maybe we're already there. Who knows?
It's interesting, though, isn't it? We're having these conversations because we genuinely don't know what to do. As you said, we are very much tempting fate here, and hopefully Sir Bert Millichip and all the footballing gods will look down kindly upon us. But we've never done, like, apart from our, you know, some our parents who, grandparents or whoever was, you know, around in 66, we just don't know what to do. What are we supposed to do? Are we supposed to have street parties? Like, is that a thing? Like, where do we watch the match? It's like, I know what to do for quarterfinals and semifinals. I've done them before, but I don't know what to do. I don't know
that
what
true,
proper
actually.
Protocol is for a final.
It's true, because in the World Cup, when England played Croatia, and obviously Croatia, a very good side, as we found out to our cost, but it was conceivable that England could win that game. I remember finding it really weird to imagine the possibility of England being in the final and where I would watch it. And I remember there being a lot of talk about, like, big screenings at Hyde Park and everyone kind of saying, well, you've got to go there.
Yeah.
You've got to go to Hyde Park. Why would you not? Yeah. Why would you watch it in the pub like you've watched every other game? It's just absolutely ludicrous. It'd be crap to watch it in Hyde Park.
I mean, such is our level of befuddlement about how we're going to feel and what we're going to do if England win a tournament, James. You know, I'm scraping the barrel for places for inspiration about, you know, instruction of what to do here. Even like the betting adverts, the generic football fan betting adverts, have never told us and have never envisaged this situation of winning a tournament. It's all just a goal going in a random game. We don't know what we're supposed to do. There is no script.
What's going to be even worse is what happens afterwards. Like, if England win the tournament, I don't know, you know, anyone Welsh or Scottish or Irish or from anywhere else in the world listening to this is probably going to be, you know, especially if they're listening to this on Thursday morning, may well be pissing themselves now.
Fine. But
if England win this tournament, we're not going to know what to do with ourselves. Like, how do we go into the World Cup? If we've won the Euros, how do we approach the World Cup?
Can you see yourself getting bored of it?
Do you have the hunger after that?
Yeah, I don't
know. It's felt like such an unattainable thing for such a long time to win a tournament and then suddenly be going into the next one, especially because it's coming around so quickly.
Yeah.
It's going to be really weird.
There is a danger that the whole rhetoric could become quite tedious after 2 months. Like, you know, even Leicester winning the league got a bit boring after a while. It's like, oh, God, the fairy tale. It's going to be like that.
It was sort of sad, wasn't it, when Ranieri got sacked after that amazing situation. And that might happen with Southgate. Like, there will become a moment at some point where England aren't good again.
Yeah. Definitely.
And yeah, it'll be tough. But I mean, literally, my disgust at all three of us is ramping up with each word that comes out of our mouths here. We really are tempting the fate here.
Oh, yeah, no, sorry. I know not. Adam doesn't believe in this, but honestly, this is killing me.
I'm getting very nervous.
Yeah, well, we're only halfway through this section as well, because I've got more. I'm going to be piling it on. Don't worry, because the more wry we get, the less it's going to feel like we're tempting fate. It's fine. We're not celebrating it. If anything, we're taking the piss out of the idea. So Stephen Liggett, James, suggests that a range of special royal stamps are inevitable.
Of course.
Would you buy them and use them? I think I would.
Well, I mean, if you're buying them and using them, you're not. I mean, that's weird, isn't it? Surely, if you're going to go out of your way to buy them, you don't use them.
Keep them.
Well, yeah. Like collectibles, aren't they? Surely.
Oh yeah. No, it's good. Good point. Now you've got to play the long game. In fact, I would go even further. I think for the first point in my life, Dave, I would be inclined to go and buy a commemorative coin, one of those coins that are advertised on TV. That probably pound for pound, no pun intended, the tackiest adverts I've ever seen. Commemorative coin adverts.
Well, commemorative plates, I think, are slightly worse.
Oh, yeah. You get those on the back of the Times or something, don't you?
Yeah.
Yeah, or like, yeah, in the magazine with like the or News of the World or whatever, yeah. Which still exists, right?
But all those magazines that you used to get advertised on telly, where like with the first issue you get a big
yes.
thing like a plate
or such a good
like
deal.
Or like a plane.
It's always a fighter jet.
Yeah,
no, it's the dinosaur, isn't it? And everyone has the same bit, right? The spine and the head of a T-Rex. Everyone had that as a kid. If you were kind of
issue
born in the mid 80s, you had that as a child. The spine and the skull of the T-Rex. I bet everyone had that.
And then yeah, issue two, the price goes up to $6.99 out of nowhere. Now I think the closest I came to buying one of those incredibly implied value magazines was Military Watches. I realise that makes me sound like Mark Corrigan from Peter. But I was like, you get a watch every week? That sounds amazing.
Military Watches.
They was like getting a watch with every magazine. So really cool. Not into my military history, should add. But, you know,
Just into watches. Is that better?
Yeah, watches. Yeah, a free watch of the magazine. That's incredible. Better than a fucking dinosaur, mate.
Can I just say... The dinosaur skeleton glows in the dark, so more for you.
Sorry, where are we?
Will we have banknotes? Will they put someone, will Southgate on a £50 note?
Sterling, surely.
Yes.
Well, clever. Yeah, exactly.
Clever.
It's right there for him.
Matty Cash, sad that he's not in the squad. Dave, I put it to you that within a year of England lifting the trophy, as you already imagining, someone will have a child named Jordan, Kyle, Harry, John, Luke, Calvin, Declan, Bukayo, Mason, Raheem, Harry.
And it'll probably be the child of the man who lives three lines day every day.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Page 7 of a tabloid newspaper is going to be this guy's forever. He's going to have a little gimmick for every single day. On to relatively more serious matters, James. Ben Law asks... will there be a debate about whether a star should be added to the crest for winning a Euros or whether it should be just reserved for World Cups? That would be getting ahead of ourselves, wouldn't it? That would be too Bob behaviour, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. I mean, do other Silver countries star? Have them for the Euros? Or is it just for the World Cup?
I don't think they do they?
But if you've only won, if you've been waiting for so long, I feel like England would do like a little silver star or something.
You need
like
to come up with another little logo to put on there then, don't you, to commemorate winning the European Championship instead.
You could have stars beneath the badge for Euros, above the badge for World Cups.
Something like that.
I don't know. Yeah.
Or the collar or something hidden away. But one thing I'm fairly sure about, Dave, is that, I mean, as good as this team are performing, it doesn't feel like this is the sort of team that they would say, this team are going to go on and dominate international football. This isn't the start of something, really, is it?
It doesn't feel like we're going to be... It doesn't feel like Spain 2008, you know, where we've got a chance to win the next three tournaments in a row.
This is genuinely fate-tempting territory, actually. I realise we have gone a step too far, actually.
But we're too far into it now. We've got to carry on. But it feels like a moment, doesn't it? It feels like we're on the crest of a wave here.
It's all right if it's the only one. To me, it doesn't matter at all.
But not many. Spain are the exception, aren't they? That was not many teams do go on to dominate international football, really, do they? You know, back to back tournaments, Euros. Mm. That Spain team's the only one I think is
France 98.
France 98, I suppose. Yeah. But it's quite rare.
That way
so
around.
I think it would. But another point is the World Cup is close. You know, it's 18 months away. So
momentum.
But again, that'll be a weird. It'll be a weird World Cup. So
if taking it two steps too far.
Here we go.
If we did, let's get
that second star.
If we did win this, you know, relatively speaking, absurdly situated Euros, and then going on to win the most ridiculous World Cup of all time. I think, generally speaking. In about 50 years, we'll look back and go, that's a bit shit. It's a bit shit time to be good. The footballing gods have actually taken the piss out of you by making your team relatively competitive at the worst possible time. Agreed? Agreed.
Yeah, roll on Euro 2024.
Dave, Elizabeth Barnard says, so we talk about 1966 in the national psyche, and that's great. If England win, do we talk about 2020 or 2021? Good question.
Oh, yeah, that is a great
question. So if you talk about the tournament, I guess you'd say, obviously, you would say Euro 2020. But, I mean, we're not. We're going to be referred to the year, so 2021.
The heroes of 2021. It's a real conundrum because, obviously, the whole... We're still calling... Everyone is... We've kind of accepted now that it's Euro 2020. Mm. That's just the way it is because of the fucking branding had to stay the same. Yes. We'd already printed it. We couldn't change it.
Didn't want to reprint the sticker books.
Yeah. So, but I kind of think it will be referred to as 2020. I think because that's the tournament, that's the Euro 2020 winning side. I think I
was inclined to think the other way around. I mean, it's not ideal for the year to be what it is, but it is what it is, and I think it will remember it as such. James, where are you leaning?
2020. Stick with the branding. You've got to stay true to the branding always, above all else.
Do you think we've angered the football gods enough now?
Well, yeah, 100%. Yeah.
Ted Croker's really angry.
Gordon McKee. Yes. Anyway, yes, I do believe that's enough fate tempting for one night. We're only in the semi-finals. What are we doing?
Will there be a retrospective clamour for... Because if the government do, or the Queen, or whoever, who decides to knight people, it's the Queen, isn't it? So if the Queen decides to give them knighthoods when they win the tournament, but then you've got, poor old Jimmy Greaves and anyone else who's left from the 66 World Cup team who aren't knighted, and obviously Bobby Moore is, you know, the whole posthumous knighted thing as well. Like, sure, well, they have to go back and do it all. That'll be tricky for them, won't they?
That's true. You'd be digging up all those old campaigns.
So it's an administrative nightmare, isn't it? Just bin it off. Just get loose to Denmark. It'll be much easier.
Will Jeff Hurst be secretly a bit annoyed if England win the tournament? Yeah.
I really hope Kane scores hat trick in the final for that reason alone, and I hope it's miles better as well, and I hope all the goals are
miles over
verified immediately. that is truly enough. I started off this episode thinking it would be quite funny to talk about England winning Euros. Now I do feel quite genuinely nervous about the prospect of having done so.
I feel like we should make some sort of sacrifice to the footballing gods here, or some sort of
burn your wall jar.
We've got to do something to to balance it out.
Still very troubled by the idea of you leaving your wall jar up for a week. But yeah, I'm off to buy a long sleeve shirt. So thank you, Sir David Walker. And thanks to you, James Moore, MBE, for joining me. Sorry, it's just the minutes. It's minutes played on the old podcast. Trundling towards the line where I say goodbye, everyone. Goodbye, everyone. See you next time. Cheers.
The Athletic.